The TNT Shop has great gift ideas for your furry family member. And we don't mean your Aunt Dolores.
You stink!
The TNT Shop has it all. At TNTRadio.live. This is McBride and Brennan on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome to McBride and Brennan. I'm Major David McBride, military whistleblower. And I'm joined with my intrepid wingman, offsider, Butch Cassidy to my Sundance kid, Dr. Robert Brennan, hopefully.
Yes, I'm here. He is there. Us two plucky amateur journalists this week, we're joined by a real one. So
yeah, we are actually joined by a man of substance. And I'm going to read his bio because I'm going to read it all because I thought it was great. Almost put a tear to my eyes. Dean Yates was head of the mental health and well-being strategy at Reuters, the world's largest news provider, for nearly 3 years until January 2020. Before that, he was a journalist, bureau chief, and senior editor at Reuters for more than 22 years. Lots of twos in this. Dean was the ideal war correspondent, courageous, compassionate, dedicated. After years of facing the worst, though, including the Bali bombings and the Boxing Day tsunami, one final incident undid him. In July 2007, two of his staff members were brutally gunned down by an American helicopter in Iraq. What followed was an unraveling of everything Dean thought he knew of himself. His PTSD was compounded by his moral wound, the devastation of what he thought he knew of the world, and his own character and beliefs. After years of treatments, including several stints inside a psychiatric facility, Dean has reshaped his view of the true meaning of life. Here in all its guts and glory is that journey to a better way of being. That is pretty good. I'm even going to say, notes for media. Line in the Sand is a life-changing roadmap for anyone trying to heal from trauma. So you've actually, in this book, Dean explains the moral dimension of trauma and explains why the term PTSD is so limiting for some. Well, very good point. Dean's book shows that it might take years, but men can learn to express emotions. We can discuss that with Dr. Robert Brennan. Dean shares his breathtaking insight into the consequences of not taking workplace mental health seriously. I can agree with that. This book is a call to action for organizational leaders and will inspire them to do a better job, feel better about themselves, and build a better workplace legacy. That's a pretty good claim. This one I don't fully understand. We're going to discuss this. Clinicians will learn something because Dean never gave his good ones or women a chance to rest with his passion for recovery. This is particularly relevant given the failure of modern day therapy to achieve reasonable, let alone ambitious goals. Okay, that one, Robert Brennan could get stuck into that one. And Dean is now a mental health expert and advocate based in Tasmania. We're going to have to go down there and visit him at some point. He commits his time helping organizations with mental health strategy and training, hosting the Mindorama podcast, and managing, I love this, his youngest son's rock band, Frogs in Suits. I don't know whether I've heard of them because of you or they are famous. But welcome, Dean.
Thank you. Thank you, David and Robert. That was a hell of an introduction, I got to say.
Yes.
Yeah. Welcome. Well, I read it and I loved it so much. I thought I'm going to go through all of this because actually I learned something myself. And if anyone's tuning in, there is there's a lot more to you than I even thought. And I think it seems to me that you've achieved something that's quite significant. I know the book's selling well, but people are. And it's a beautiful lesson in life in that you not unlike Brené Brown or whatever, you've admitted your vulnerability has become your greatest strength, and you have said I struggled with this, and you haven't just said that. I mean, you really went into detail about it, and as a result, you have cutting away the bullshit from the truth. You've established some real truths. And are helping people, and by helping people, you're helping yourself because you've obviously that's nothing. There's no better way to restore your self-esteem than becoming a leader in a field, helping other people, and you talk from a point of strength and credibility because you've really been there. Not that others haven't, but you put a bit of thought into I went down into the well, put a bit of thought about how to get out, got out, and now you've got a roadmap where you can help other people. But that's enough talking for me. Tell us, we've gone through the, give us a thumbnail sketch of your life in a minute or two so we can get to know you a bit from your own words.
Look, I think firstly, David, thank you for all those kind words. And to be honest, that book took 7 years to write. And so I had a lot of time to think about how to write it, what it was going to say. And it was a tough thing to write because I had to go over a lot of material. But before I just talk a little bit about myself, I have been absolutely overwhelmed by the reaction of ordinary people to this book, the messages I'm getting, the emails, the messages on social media, people, you know, coppers who are sending me messages, the wives of veterans who are sending me messages, who are saying this book is just helping me understand the moral dimension of my trauma, for example, or just giving me a bit of an idea of why I was feeling the way I felt about how I was treated in the workplace. And that has just been so validating for me. It's made that those 4 a.m. starts when I'd get up and start writing all worthwhile. And so it's just, it's really been for me immensely satisfying and heartwarming to see that response.
Go on.
I think the how I got there, you know, is a story that I think is one that I, as a journalist, I just literally found myself, depending on how you look at it, in the right place at the right time or the wrong place at the wrong time. I was just, I got very lucky at the age of 25. I was living in Indonesia. I was in Jakarta trying to get into the media. I desperately wanted to be a journalist. A few years before that, I'd been backpacking through Europe. I'd climbed the Berlin Wall. I'd gone through Eastern Europe. And, you know, the wall had just come down and I was just so fascinated by history and the Cold War and so on. And I really wanted to be a correspondent. I wanted to witness history being made. And I found myself in Indonesia. The international news agency Reuters was looking for a reporter. And by this time, I could speak Indonesian fluently. And they hired me to cover the stock market in Indonesia. Within 3 months, they sent me to cover an earthquake on Sumatra that killed 200 people. That was the start of what for me became this sort of roller coaster ride for the next more than two decades of just sometimes just getting a phone call and getting on a plane and going to cover some of these major events of the last 20, 25 years, whether it was the Bali bombings, the Boxing Day tsunami, earthquakes that people wouldn't even remember, or Iraq, which of course was the big one. And I first went there at the end of 2003. I saw Iraq go from bad to worse. I saw it go from a place where you could feel the insurgency starting to fester to being the bureau chief in 2007 when Iraq was in all-out civil war, all because of that illegal and mad invasion and occupation. And I spent a lot of time in Iraq. I spent nearly 700 days and nights I spent in total in Baghdad. And it was hell on earth. And then for me to ultimately have two of my staff killed in what became known as the collateral murder incident was something that all of these events eventually caught up with me. And I became suicidal. I mean, this just took such a toll on me, all that trauma, all that witnessing. And luckily, my wife, Mary, realized how grave the situation was. And she got me into this psych ward in Melbourne, Ward 17, very well-known place for veterans. A lot of veterans in there, a lot of coppers, a lot of AMBOs and firefighters. And that was the turning point in my life because in there I found I got the insight into trauma that I didn't have. I got the expertise, I had an amazing treating team. And I kept going back there until I found myself on a firm footing.
Wow, gobsmacked. It's and of course I'm quiet because there's a lot of similarities between your story and mine.
I was
just thinking of the parallels, and I'm going to have to confess I haven't got your book yet, and I'll have to get it and read it because that healing element really appeals to me. I knew I was very angry, and because I was a soldier and we had, and I went to Sandhurst in the sort of late 80s, 90s, probably, you know, what, closer to the Second World War than now. And we took things seriously. We took, truth, honor, integrity, these things meant something. People died for truth. And to see that the world, or at least the world we lived in 2013, was very different to, was completely the opposite to that, sent me around the twist as well. And particularly in that when I tried to do something about it, I just met brick wall after brick wall. Like a rat in a maze, I when I'm writing my book at the moment, and I'm, don't worry about taking 5 years to write yours, I'm like 4 years and counting.
But I think that's good though, David. I think that's good. The worst thing would be if you push something out in a year, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's going to be a stream of consciousness. You need time.
I'm very lucky. I funnily enough, it just started to flow this year, even though it's been 4 years. Pretty much everything that will be published in my book is written in 2023. In that it's been like an ice cream machine, I think, you know, but it comes out too thick. Comes out too thin,
yeah.
And finally the mixture is right. And I don't know about your book. I've sort of dealt with my whole life, but when I finally stopped trying to over egg the pudding, and I just tell it, say what happened without any embellishment. It's pretty good. I suddenly realised to myself, wow, this is chronological, saying what happened, and that's where it gets its power. It's surprisingly powerful, a bit like someone, as you would have heard in the hospital, as I was in a similar hospital in Wollongong, which psychiatric hospital with a lot of veterans and cops. And when someone tells their story in an unembellished way, while it's good to laugh about, you know, funny things, but if someone just tells their story in an unembellished way, it can be very powerful. Going from this, I saw this, you know, whatever, saw it, came across a terrible accident, you know, terrific injuries to a two-year-old or whatever, did this, did that, you know, whatever, got on top of a cliff, thought about jumping off. Whatever it is the person's story is, they don't have to really embellish it and your eyes are like, oh, wow, that's pretty full on.
I think the challenge for me, David, was to get out of the journalist's head and go into and to become an author, essentially, yeah. Right? And so you've probably had a similar thing, right? You've got to get out of your lawyer's head. You've got to get out of your soldier's head to become an author. But I reckon by year four, you're probably in that author's head now.
I was very much like that, yeah.
Yeah.
That must have been what flowed. Yeah, it's almost like some sort of divine intervention, because I woke up one morning, I thought I didn't have very long to get this done. And I'm like you, I'm a morning writer. I found that I don't get up at four. I did try four, and that worked. But I was kind of, I took too long to warm up at four. I decided the best way to do it was to get up at six or five. Get up at five, wake up at five, have a cup of coffee, and start writing. And I'm a real caffeine addict. Start writing even before you've finished your first cup of coffee, because that's when you're most honest, when you're too tired to lie.
Yeah.
When you just tell it like it was, you know.
Yeah.
And without trying to think, oh, does that make me look bad? Does that make me look good? Does that make me, what am I trying to make people feel? Once I got rid of that ego and just said, I'm just going to describe what happened, and try to even shut out all the sort of mental inner dialogue that I was thinking at the time, because that's just, obviously that you have so much in a dialogue, and it, you just can't put it, unless for really important stuff, you can't put that in. You just got to say, you know, I went to the Berlin and the walls coming down, and I got some pieces, and you know, when I got home, my dad said, well, that's junk, whatever. And but the story is interesting enough, but it took me a while to get that, to say, wow, there's enough in this. You don't have time to talk too much about what things look like unless it's really, really relevant. And you just don't waste any words and just say what happened. And for me, everyone's different, but I mean, for me, that really cleared it. And yeah. I only write for an hour or two. I write 1,000 words or more, but I have a routine, and you'd be the same. I like routine. I do it every day, even a Sunday.
Yeah.
I'd get up and start writing. It's from 6 to 7, and then it started to flow. Then I got it done. I'm enjoying talking to you. I don't want to take up too much time, but there's a lot of it now because I had that moral injury as well.
And I could imagine, David, for you, right? The moral dimension of what has been done to you. I'm going to ask you a question here, right? I'm going to put my old journalist hat on.
Ah, but gentlemen, if we can hold everyone in suspense, we've got to go to an ad break. This is TNT.
suspense.
TNT Radio's Jesse Zurawell.
Deep sea mining, which you and I have talked about before, and this month is a very busy and arguably pivotal month for the future of deep sea mining.
Yeah, so this month in particular is very important because it marks exactly 2 years since Nauru, you know, the small Commonwealth nation in the Pacific, enacted what's called a quote unquote 2-year rule, which basically means that the International Seabed Authority, ISA, this corrupt, arbitrary, non-transparent body established by a UN treaty, can issue contracts to countries and other commercial companies to go and mine the seabed in international waters. People try to push forward deep sea mining because it's this idea that, oh, well, you know, it's less costly than land mining. Well, in reality, companies that are already heavily engaged in land mining aren't going to stop because of commercial deep sea mining. A prime example of that is the country of France.
Jesse Zurawell on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
This is a message for the parents of young children in the United States. I am Dr. Tess Laurie from the World Council for Health. Please consider the danger of vaccinating your children and babies with the COVID-19 injections. They are not the same as traditional vaccines and are causing significant harm to children around the world. Your children have their whole lives ahead of them. They are not endangered by COVID at all. Please hear us when we say, for your children, it is much safer to wait. Thank you.
You're with David McBride and Dr. Robert Brennan on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to McBride and Brennan. I'm Major David McBride, military whistleblower. I've got Dr. Robert Brennan somewhere.
Ahoy.
And we have Dean Yates. I think that's the fastest 20 minutes we've had because Dean and I could not stop talking. Now we cut you off, Dean. What were you going to say?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the things that's really probably the thing that's most resonated from my book, the thing that people are saying has really grabbed them the most has been moral injury, right? It's this moral dimension of trauma, this idea that people have either been betrayed by their workplace, by government, or that they've done something which has so transgressed their moral compass, their conscience, and they've been haunted by that. And, you know, moral injury is akin to PTSD in a way. I mean, I'm absolutely, in a journalistic sense, David, I'm fascinated in your situation. How has moral injury, how has this moral dimension of trauma played out in your situation, given that you have told, you sought the truth of what was happening in Afghanistan and you're being punished for it. You've been put on trial for it. How does that play out for you?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And it makes the hair stand on the back of my neck. And it's that dark area where you almost don't want to go there. And I think that was one of the, it drove me for a while, but it was also a bit dangerous. It was like that kind of white hot, with like a nuclear reactor inside of me, you know, because I was so incredibly angry about it. In fact, you know, I don't know, with various different, and your story is, I don't know if I've ever read a story, even though, you know, slightly different because you're a journalist, whatever, but there is there are strong similarities with our stories. And I was so white hot angry, and I was, that makes it kind of hard to express what you're actually feeling to people. And I've had to kind of temper that to say, I will, you know, I'm not going to think about that. I have a goal. I have a goal to get justice. I have a goal to get change in our defence force, and not only in our defence force, in our government, and not only in our government, in the Western world. And that will drive me, and I will put my anger aside until that happens. And I sometimes hear stories and I have to kind of titter laugh about it, because if I get too deep into it, I'm like, that will just make me so angry. I just have to, temper what I'm feeling and just think, oh, well, worry about that later. Don't think about that too much. Try to laugh about that rather than get furious. I used to. it can be the right thing at the right time. I've been, while I don't actually see the, it's an analogy which I first I had it in my book a fair bit, but I probably cut it out because it's, we don't want to make it too complex. But it's not beyond the, it's quite a good vehicle to explain what I felt, that I see ghosts to a certain extent. You probably do too, and that I saw ghosts not so much of Afghanistan, but of the early Anzacs. You know, I used to imagine them back in my garden in Canberra, covered in mud. I'm not sure if they were dead or undead or in their uniforms, and they'd just stare at me and didn't have to say anything. There were no voices, but it was just the look enough to say, you have a duty to fix this, because we have lost the Anzac spirit. This is a disgrace. This is an abomination. And you are the guy in the frame, and you have to keep going on with this. And you know, all those words can be put into one word. You know what the right thing to do is, and you know that you can't give up. And I did always feel the voices of the past, ancestors, fathers, whatever, kind of drive you on. They don't tell you what to do day to day, of course, and you have to work that out by trial and error, trying everything, seeing what works, seeing what doesn't, firing at shadows, diversion plans, all that kind of thing. But I was certainly very driven. I don't know how much of it was nature or nurture, but or a training at Sandhurst, but I saw it as not surprisingly, but also it helped me to see it as a military mission. And I see it now. I see it still in terms of the Second World War, and this has kind of helped me. That's what I grew up on. That's all my sort of imagery is that. And so I don't mind the time span. I sort of think of the 6 years of the Second World War, and I see that of battles happening or the Western Front, Eastern Front, Italian Front, North Africa campaign, and I can see making small inroads. I can see your book is a battle in my mission. Stalingrad, perhaps. It's a big thing. We're going to move forward. And the fact that a lot of things have happened lately. People don't really understand what moral injury is. I've done a few talks about it.
Yep.
Some people do, obviously. But the fact that because of your book, more and more people are hearing about it, that's fantastic. That helps me. I'll be able to help you. Things like the robo debt that came out recently, and the truth about what big government departments, psychology of people who just know they're doing the wrong thing, but just do it anyway.
On robo debt, David, that has got moral injury all over it, right? It has absolutely all over it. I mean, all of those victims of robo-debt, right, against a government that was fleecing them of money that they didn't owe, and then these people couldn't get any recourse for years. People were taking their own lives and so on. And then you have the poor civil servants who were actually trying to get this sorted. And then they were being told to shut up. There's moral injury potentially for those folks as well. And then on top of it, you have a coalition party that will still not apologize properly for this. It is just extraordinary.
We had that. We had Jeff Morris on last week, actually, and we said that. And that's, I guess, that shows you how big this problem is. We were Gladys Berejiklian is still saying, "I did nothing wrong."
Yes. Yeah.
And I don't know whether she believes it or not, but there's a section of the public that believe it. Ben Robert Smith saying, "I did nothing wrong. I'm going to appeal. There's a huge conspiracy against me." At least he says he seems to acknowledge that the allegations, if true, were bad. But Gladys is like, nothing, you know, even everything I did, even though it's been proven, there was nothing wrong with that. And who doesn't give $20 million to a hospital to make your lover happy on Valentine's Day?
And just to put it, put things in context for our listeners, Dean Yates, the author of Line in the Sand, was running the Baghdad Bureau for Reuters in 2007 when two of his colleagues, Iraqi colleagues, that being a driver and a photographer, Namia and Saeed, were gunned down by Apache helicopter that later became, the footage of which became the leak from the then Bradley Manning, now Chelsea Manning, to WikiLeaks that became the infamous collateral murder video that's now been seen by countless millions of people. And so, you know, the question is PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And if you consider, okay, if we're going to make a claim of diagnosis or a claim in sort of in a compensation hearing, then there are certain criteria that need to be met because, you know, there's a Bible of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, right? And as it happens, Dean, you fit that criteria because you either have to have your own life or limb threatened or be up close and personal with those who have had their own life or limb threatened or have lost it.
Correct.
Or repeated trauma such that you experience, say, in the seeing of countless dead bodies after the Bali bombing, after the Indonesian tsunami, and so on and so forth. So you meet that criteria, but for many people, you know, the question is, well, even if they don't strictly meet that criteria, have they suffered such a wound of a loss of trust, of a loss of faith, of betrayal, or whatever, in relation to big picture issues that you could say that be morally injured, they've been demoralized. They've suffered a massive loss of trust. They have a massive grief reaction, betrayal. That's a provocation to vengeance and that sort of thing. Because and I was wondering if this was bringing me up to what you could comment on, is that it does seem to me in my readings of what you did that you did try and bring the story out as best you could, but the writer's executive sort of put the ice on it a little bit. They wanted to not rock the boat too much with the US generals when they didn't release the transcripts. And then in 2008, Reuters routed you to the least war-torn place on the planet, Singapore, and so sort of getting you out of the picture. So so what is your take on Reuters at this time, particularly within the context of which they were also involved in a merger that they didn't want to rock the boat with a massive Thomson Group?
Yeah, look, I think a really good question here, Robert, is about moral injury and PTSD, right? And how PTSD is a very limiting diagnosis for a lot of people. And what's really fascinating here is that the experts who have pioneered the moral injury research and the moral injury literature have made very, very clear that to get moral injury, you don't have to go through a Criterion A event, right? You don't have to go through a life threat event. You don't have to be exposed to serious violence, sexual assault, have your life threatened to develop moral injury, like you do for PTSD. So when you look at someone, and again, this robo-debt example is such a good example of it because it's just such a horrendous breach of trust for so many people. When someone has been so has been so victimized by a government over such a long period of time. Okay, it might not have been a direct threat to their life, but it has been a direct threat to their livelihoods. It has been a direct threat to their way of life, and it has broken their trust in the government of the day. And that's that betrayal which, when it becomes so severe, it can result in essentially psychiatric symptoms. It can result in people becoming dysfunctional, because if that trust has been broken, then who do people believe in? That if they can't believe in their government, if they can't believe in fairness, in justice, then what do they believe in? And so this is why I think moral injury is a very good can provide very good context for how people are trying to make sense of the way they feel about the world as it is run today, how things are being and what is being done to them, whether it is government actions such as robo-debt, whether it's the climate crisis. All right, you have got a lot of people now around the world who are getting psychiatric help because of their concerns about the climate and the fact that nothing is being done about it. I think moral injury, and I'm actually having people contacting me since my book came out and asking, can moral injury help explain why some people are starting to feel very distressed about the climate crisis?
Mm. Yeah, that's right.
Well, I like that because I got a diagnosis. I'm probably a good example for you. I'll come along as a guinea pig if you need to do your talk. But because I believe I've got moral injury rather than PTSD. Mm. I mean, the PTSD. I did it because it was approximately. It was close enough, and it was. In fact, it's only really the light bulb just clicked on when you were talking. It was close enough to say that in that psychologically, I was, damaged by what happened. But it was, as I tried to say to them at the time, while it was hard to, it wasn't really the bombs going off and things in Afghanistan. It was me fighting with my organization over them not. And I think the best way I can use to describe it is when your organization, its very reason for being is to do something, and it doesn't do that thing. And not only does it not do that thing, it tries to destroy some part of it, which is actually trying to do the right thing. You know, it's a snake biting its own tail. And that is... that is when you get moral injury. I mean, I can imagine it if you were a good, honest priest in the Catholic Church in the 1970s in Ballarat or somewhere, I reckon you'd have moral injury or you'd be dead. You know, in the sense that you might have complained about your fellow priest to the bishop or whatever it is, and complain, and then found out that the whole organization was riddled. At one of our friends, Alicia Rose, down in the Ashley Youth Detention Centre, complained about, she's been physically assaulted, but if she complained about, she suspected one of her staff members was perhaps a tendency to abuse children, and found out that the whole staff members, and in fact, that's probably, that's why they got the job there in the first place. I mean, it's almost like a horror movie when you realize that the organization you work for are the bad guys or are so infiltrated with bad guys. That is when it really burns you,
it's this high stakes. It's the nature of the situation, right? It's such a high stakes situation. And this was the original definition of moral injury that was coined by Jonathan Shea, this American psychiatrist who was treating Vietnam veterans, US Vietnam veterans. And it was the betrayal of these soldiers by their commanders in a high-stakes situation, or by their government when they return back from the war. And so in your situation, it is the betrayal is by your government, by our government, and the stakes couldn't be higher, right? You are revealing war crimes, and then they turn on you for doing that, right? Your whole livelihood is at stake. And so that really is a very clear-cut example of how moral injury could take root. And it's, yeah, but then, and we are seeing this, I'm seeing this repeated throughout organizations because of the organizational culture that has taken root in the West.
Oh yeah, no, it's definitely, and that's one of the things you discover is I imagine in the Reuters, I don't know about Reuters, but it's a corporation made to make money, and you would imagine that people get promoted about how well they can make money, not how well that they actually do good things. And I know in the Defence Force as well, what increasingly incensed me was to see that people became generals by being yes men and doing the wrong thing frequently, but actually getting rewarded for it. So we end up with an organisation where the people at the very top are selected by kind of how bad they are, not how good they are.
Yeah.
And I said this to a psychiatrist. I said once, I said, I can't believe a psychologist actually, who was assessing me, and I was explaining to her, and she says, because they were trying to get rid of me, and they tried, there's so many wheels within wheels in my case, they tried to get me, you know, get rid of me by giving me a psychological assessment, which they were hoping was going to say I was, you know, broken. And actually, they didn't say I was broken. It said, to her credit, she said, he's very angry, but he's not broken. He's very angry what he's seen. And I said to her at the end of the year, I said, why would someone who spent 40 years in the military wearing uniform, getting all the way to the top, and there's nowhere else they can be promoted to, why would they dud their own people in order to get an extra medal? You know, they can't even get a medal. And she was like, if you've been crawling all your life, you cannot stop crawling after 40 years. And it was a real shock to me. And that's, we seem to, it's almost the, you know, we used to think it was the rare exceptions, but a lot of our institutions have been hijacked by people. We see it in the cops. Obviously, you get a lot of people from the cops that get, you know, people who get to the top are frequently causing moral injury because you're told to shut up.
Yeah.
We don't want to hear about that. We don't want troublemakers. We pretend that we're here to protect and serve. We're actually here to do whatever else. We just heard on the news before you came on, you might have been listening, that a senior police officer has been, you know, having a sort of some sort of long-term abusive, you know, affair with a 13-year-old guy. He's like, he's probably in charge of child protection or something, you know. That's the sort of thing that can send you around the twist to say, hang on, this is the exact opposite. And not only, it's not just that one case. If you complained about it, then you become the problem. And you're like, wow, this is really bad. That we had another guest on here, Peter Fox, who was one of the whistleblowers that got the institutional, or the Royal Commission into Institutional Child Abuse off the ground. A very, very straight detective, 40 years in the force or something, you know, and you meet him. I just saw him again last night, and he's much straighter than, you know, he looks like a cop. He still looks like a cop. And he's certainly not, there's nothing sort of eccentric about him at all. And yet he wouldn't give up on this child in the Catholic Church. And he got shut down. Not only did he get shut down, but he kind of became the problem.
Yeah, that's right. Or you have the case of the doctor whose wife was arrested for violating lockdown and thrown in the back of a paddy wagon, and then he was suspended from practice for 9 months for criticising government health policy. And I might add that his wife, this being me, was arrested in the name of the diktat of the chief health officer. So, you know, lots of moral injury all around. But on that note, we're going to go to a break. This is TNT.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
I've talked a lot about the racism that has now become acceptable in the United States, racism against white people. I've discussed campus living arrangements that prohibit white students, job forums that list those who are welcome with one race notably absent from the invite, teachers unions that will ignore seniority of white teachers when it comes to laying them off. It goes on and on. Now comes this. There's a bill being pushed by Democrats in California that would make judges take the race of criminals into account when handing down a sentence. That's right, take race into consideration when handing down a sentence. This racist and surely unconstitutional bill was passed by the state house and is now in the Senate. Now, under the bill, courts would be making up for how minorities have been treated in the past by going easy on current minority criminals who come before the judges. White people would, of course, get no such special treatment, of course. I wish I was making this up, but I'm not. The sanctioning of racism continues to spread, and it needs to stop before it's too late. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio.
The MAGA Institute is dedicated to helping create a more informed, more involved, and more active electorate by providing a unique combination of candidate vetting and certification with voter information resources, constitutional education, and volunteer training. Our secret sauce is our nationwide network of volunteers who help us learn which candidates truly are for we the people. Go to MAGAinstitute.com to join our candidate vetting volunteer network or to support our mission with your donation. A message brought to you by TNT Radio.
You're with David McBride and Dr. Robert Brennan on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to McBride and Brennan. I'm Major David McBride, military whistleblower. I think we're having perhaps the best discussion we've ever had with Dean Yates, author of Line in the Sand. Dr. Robert Brennan, found another victim of moral injury, of course. In fact, there'd be a lot of you in the medical profession, I imagine.
Not enough, actually. Cowardice is our biggest speciality, I'm sorry to say.
Actually, there was a piece just speaking of the medical profession, David. There was an amazing piece in the New York Times recently about moral injury among surgeons and doctors in America. Because of the corporatization of health in America and how doctors, surgeons are being forced to compromise essentially on their Hippocratic oath, on their duties as doctors, and are finding it is so difficult for them to do what they feel they should be doing as doctors because they're beholden to spreadsheets, beholden to hospital administrators, and that this is just driving them insane.
Yeah, I read. I don't know if it's heavy reading for people like us, but it's an amazing book called Crisis of Conscience. It's about a compendium of American whistleblowers, beautifully written, and some of the most harrowing medical ones from particular hospitals run on a sort of a profit and loss. And some doctors, if you can call them that, have come straight out with the intention of getting as rich as they possibly can, as quick as they possibly can. They come up against some people who don't have that attitude, and it becomes a bloodbath. And that moral injury, where do people get it? Especially doctors, where do people come out of medical school with the idea that the human is worth life is worth nothing compared to you getting a new car? And and you can imagine if you're a good doctor and you come out and you see that. My father was a whistleblower and a doctor, and he was born in 1927, and he wasn't necessarily warm and fluffy, but he could see the politicization of medicine was going to be a problem, you know. And while I don't know if it's hard to get that balance right, but yes, once you, I know this really sums up the problem with the military, the politicization of the ADF. And it's a bit like moral injury. The term itself doesn't really do justice to what it is. I was talking about the politicization of the ADF 10 years ago, and of course no one really cared, but it makes a difference whether we give a medal to someone because they deserve it, or we give a medal to someone because the minister wants to have a good news story for this weekend because it's a by-election. And And yet, and especially if we, if everything we're meant to be based on is truth, honor, fight to the death. If you see that happening, whereby everything that you're meant to believe in is being trashed for some tawdry short-term political thing dreamt up by someone, a 23-year-old staffer who thinks it's all a great wheeze, you get very, very angry. And that's, I think that's what that was what drives that the, and again, it's probably helped you, as you said, you put your journalist head back on, you went back to war. Just for me, I put my soldier's head back on, and I am determined to fight this dragon and not rest until it is dead. And it may mean going to prison. It may mean spending quite a few years in prison. But to say that there's a sickness in so many of our institutions where people think it's okay to go completely against what they're doing. We saw about it this week that the pesticides regulatory body had been taken over by flunkies from the pesticide industry, probably for the very cheap cost of a few free lunches and a few small donations to a particular party. Now that is an abomination. That is an abomination to think we might poison our earth for a thousand generations to come, because someone like Daryl Maguire wanted to get re-elected and did it for the sake of a golf club membership or something. I mean, that is the sort of thing that makes you anyway. I'm seeking justice, I guess, and that really helps me. The tweeting helps me. I think that what gets you down, and you might be the same, and your book would have helped, is the idea that you'd be helpless.
This exactly, Dave, the powerlessness that occurs when you feel like you've been betrayed to a certain extent is all encompassing, and that is so many people feel that way. All of those victims of robo-debt felt betrayed until this Royal Commission was heard and its conclusions delivered. Now, whether or not that is real vindication for people, I'm not sure, but it's a start.
Yeah,
and I think in your situation, you writing your book is going to helps rebalance that powerlessness that you may have felt. I mean, it's still hanging over you. You've still got this trial coming up, of course.
But I mean, you just treat it like it's a battle. You're putting rounds down range. You're keeping the head down, and you're moving forward. Yeah, it's by no means over, but yes, it's your ability to fire back.
Yeah, but one thing I'm really interested to ask you, David, is what do ordinary people say to you? Because you're a pretty recognizable guy, especially with those white spectacles on. What do ordinary people say to you? Do you have people coming up and wanting to ask you about the case?
More often, I think people are polite. They generally don't think that they don't want to disturb you. They think
okay.
But if they get the chance, I mean, if you go into I was in a shop one day and when was it? Pet Barn. And they say, can you give us your phone number? And they put it in, and then something came up and he said, this young guy is about 19, and he said, are you a veteran? And I didn't know what he meant. I thought he was just saying, are you an old person? I was like, did you get a discount?
Are you a senior citizen?
And yeah. I thought he was like, do you want me to help you carrying that to the car? Or something. I said, yes. And he said, yeah, I've seen your friendly joint. He said, I want to shake your hand. And I do get that. And I do get a lot of comments online when people say you're a hero. And I love it, particularly when it's like Mr. and Mrs. Miggins, retired teacher and policeman, driving around Australia, grey nomads. Here we're sending you a $20 note because we don't trust the bank system. I love that. Mm. And you do get that a fair bit. Yeah, people say keep on going. But one of the terrible things about our world, people are a bit scared.
Yes.
They're scared for their own lives, their own jobs and whatever.
Yep.
Like you occasionally get people come up to you furtively and at a rally and say, I work for the public service. I'm a bit scared. But, you've got more people behind you than you realize.
Yeah. People are scared of speaking out, aren't they?
Yeah.
They're probably scared of liking your Facebook posts.
Yeah, well, that's right. I had a good dinner last night, and had you been here, you would have been, we had another one of these whistleblower conference, Jeff Morris, Kent Quinlan, Troy Stoltz, Peter Fox, Dr. Coe, I've forgotten his first name again, and it was a really good night. But we all agreed in a kind of black humoured way, a lot of laughter, of course, but also to say, if someone said to me today, I'm going to become a whistleblower, we'd say, don't do it.
Oh, yeah. Well, to, you know, you have to answer to your conscience. But I thought, Dean, I'd ask you about, like, by the way, I thought the coloured spectacles you're undercover as a, like a New York art dealer or something. But anyway, you know, it's the idea that you can't really escape the trauma by leaving Iraq, because when you were in holidays in Tasmania or all places at the bottom of the world, that's when the collateral murder video was released in April 2010. And coincidentally, another piece of trivia for readers, it was just 3 months or 4 months later in August when Assange, just these accusers come out of the woodwork in Sweden that started the domino, that the chain of dominoes falling that has him in prison to this day. You know, so it's like you have this repeated trauma that the system does you over, and then you have to bear witness, no matter where you are in the world, to it doing you over again and again and again and again.
Yeah, I was completely caught off guard by the release of the tape. Like you say, Robert, I was down here in Tasmania with the family. We were having a break, Cradle Mountain National Park, and I didn't even know the tape had been released, because back in those days, Cradle Mountain National Park, there was no radio, there was no phone service, no data service, nothing. And it was actually 2 days later when we came out of there and ended up in Devonport, where my wife's family lived, and saw the story in a local newspaper. And that was the first I knew that the tape had been released. Some of my editors had been trying to contact me, but I didn't have a BlackBerry then, didn't have it turned on. And so it was just an absolute shock to find that it was out there, and that all of this stuff, what I had been I'd essentially been lied to by the US generals at the time in Baghdad when I was first briefed on this. I had no idea that Sayed, our driver, had been trying to get up for 3 minutes, that he was brutally gunned down by the Apache helicopter in a second attack, which was declared a war crime by human rights lawyers and international legal experts around the world. It was a really difficult thing to have to confront quite out of left field. But then, you know, what really angers me is that Julian revealed the truth of the Iraq war. He showed people what the war in Iraq looked like through collateral murder, through the tape, through all the documents, the war logs that he published. And that showed just the true nature of that horrible conflict, that horrible invasion, occupation. And yet, he is the one on trial. He is the one being persecuted. And no one ever seems to stop and think, well, what was in those documents? What was in that tape? Let's have a look at that for a minute and see what that actually showed about the way the United States conducted war and how wrong that was. It just became a campaign of trying to tear down the man, the messenger, Julian. And unfortunately, a lot of this campaign, I think, was quite successful, because it seemed to divert attention away from what should have been the focus, which was the extrajudicial killings, the unaccounted killings of civilians in Iraq, and every other sort of atrocity that was going on that hadn't been reported on. And I just find it absolutely amazing that even on the 20th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, which we are in now, that even at this time, there are still politicians in this country from the Liberal Party that will try to justify the invasion and say, well, Saddam was a bad guy, or things like that, without even a moment's thought for the fact that It destroyed a country. It traumatized an entire nation of people.
And apart from anything else, it would talk about a moral injury on a grand scale. we pretend to be the good guys. We pretend to be do things by the rule of law, but it was a cynically organized illegal invasion where we made up the whole weapons of mass destruction. I mean, the one country that did have weapons of mass destruction which could launch within 30 minutes was the United States. And yet we didn't see, you know, I was writing about that in my book this morning. It's kind of hilarious. And we don't worry about them.
And there's been no accounting for it, David. And the man who's having to account for his actions is Julian Assange.
And one of the things that brings it home is even worse than collateral damage. John Shipton, his father, always tells a story about the idea that American troops, in a terrible abomination, went and raped a family, some teenagers. Then they killed the whole family. And then they brought an airstrike down on the house to destroy the evidence, and the commanders knew, and that was in the records. And that was actually so confronting that the Iraqis threw the whole American force out of the country and said, we're not going to renew. Now, that's the sort of stuff which, it's clear who the bad guys are, and you're right. The fact that Assange is facing jail, it's a moral injury on the grand scale. I think we're going to get cut off. I think,
ladies
this is the
and
best
gentlemen,
episode
we'll have to go to a part two with Dean sometime.
Thank you, Dean.
Thank you, David. Thank you, Robert. See you in 2 weeks, David, in Melbourne.
See you in 2 weeks in Melbourne, and I hope as many people as possible listen to this and buy your book.